Sephora stores are everywhere you are. So just pop in when you need a brown lip to match your 90s playlist, a confidence boost before your interview, or a last-minute gift for mom's birthday. There's always a Sephora near you. Just pop in. Use our store locator to find your local Sephora or Sephora at Kohl's.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University. I had the pleasure to talk with Autumn Womack, professor of English and of African American Studies at Princeton University, about her new book, The Matter of Black Living, The Aesthetic Experiment of Racial Data from 1880 to 1930, which was published from University of Chicago Press in 2022. Womack trained in English and comparative literature, so the book is central to literary studies, Black studies, American studies, and allied fields. But I want to make a strong pitch for this book for scholars in science and technology studies, in history of technology and history of science, or really anybody interested in data sciences, in developing new creative methods in our own research, or for thinking about the interplay between the sciences and artistic cultural production. As you'll hear, this project was a collaborative effort between myself, Professor Womack, and graduate students in my grad seminar on science and technology studies at Vanderbilt. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, Professor Autumn Womack, and thank you so much for talking with us today. I want to begin by saying that Vanderbilt University, which is where we are recording from, those of us in the Science and Technology Studies class, that Vanderbilt occupies the ancestral and traditional lands of the Cherokee and Shawnee people. And this land was unlawfully ceded in 1795 in the Treaty of Hopewell. And we in this class recognize Native sovereignty, and we're committed to holding ourselves and Vanderbilt University accountable to the needs of Native and Indigenous communities. And I also want to say that this is December of 2022, and so we're especially excited and keen to talk with you because we've been reading you all semester long, and we're speaking into a political moment in which a former president has just announced candidacy for presidency again in the same week as meeting with white supremacist leaders in the U.S., that there's questions around the status of science and global warming, and also lots of possibilities for transformation and the redistribution of power in the academic fields that we all work in as well. So this just feels like a really evocative and especially exciting and inspiring time to be talking with you in light of your book. Okay, so to get rolling about the book. So the book is about racial data, but it comes at racial data from a different set of commitments and assumptions than I think more traditional science and technology studies and history of science comes from the idea of racial data. And so just in terms of the nuts and bolts of it, the book focuses on America, and it specifically looks at this period from US Reconstruction, the failed Reconstruction, through the Black Arts Movement, the start of the 1930s. And I think you really persuasively show that that period in particular not only has been understudied, so it's not merely gap filling, though I'm actually a huge fan of filling gaps, but it's also crucial to understand the history and the practice of technologies and racialized data making. Yeah. And its political consequences for that period. So the earlier period, Enlightenment to ballpark 1850, has been incredible work. And you refer to Britt Russert's amazing book, Fugitive Science, as an inspiration. And then later work in the mid-20th century and post-war period of Black science, technology, and politics. But you're really looking at this period in between. And it's because you're saying that there were two concurrent experiments going on at this time. The first were experiments with technologies. And so the book is organized around three technologies that make up three, what you call chapters, but there's, we might think of them as sections, because they're these really thick and robust conversations about first the social survey, second the photograph and photography technologies, and then film and ethnological films, these sorts of things. And then in addition to technology, the second experiment was the political experiment of Black freedom.
Yeah.
And you show in the book how the experiments with the technologies and the experiments with Black freedom really leaned on each other to yield what you call really sort of excitingly undisciplined data. And this is sort of officially racial data that actually undermines the premise that the sciences can really fix and firm up Black sociality, that it can really be pinned down. So you've got these two experiments going on. So just to start us off, could you just play around with the idea of undisciplined data? What supports undisciplined data, and what are the political opportunities that it affords?
Yeah, no, thank you so much. And that was such a beautiful overview and so kind of generous in its analysis of what the book is trying to do. So thank you for that really careful, and I think correct reading. Like it got at what I was trying to do. So this idea of undisciplined data, which I think you are really right to identify as emerging right from at the intersection of the impulse, or what the book describes as the imperative of 19th century social scientists, reformers, intellectuals, really kind of the entire modern world, to understand or to solve the quote unquote, what was known as the Negro problem. And so this was an imperative that really relied upon a set of technologies and a really well-rehearsed repertoire of seemingly objective study and statistical analysis, right? And so the statistical analysis was pretty rudimentary. I mean, it was really developing. This is the moment where we get like the rise of something like the bell curve, right? But it was the statistical analysis that they were working with, or I shouldn't even say analysis, study, I should say, really relied upon kind of simple charts and graphs that compared information, right? And the idea or the goal of these kinds of charts and graphs is that you can understand Black life better if you organize Black life and Black living into certain kind of categories. So for example, birth rates, death rates, educational tendencies, where people live, kind of all of these things that are quite social, we can organize them according to data. And if we can organize Black people and Black life and the way that they live into these data sets, right, then the idea is, then we can actually control what's happening in the aftermath of Reconstruction and its failures, which was, as many people thought, total chaos, right? Just total unruliness, ungovernability, the experiment of emancipation failed, many people said. So that's like on the one side, like the idea that data can be disciplined. And what the book is really looking at is this moment when actually the what I describe as the forces of Black life, which is to say kind of the social aspect of how Black people are in the world, which is to say that kind of being together or having kids or getting married or the things that drive you to go to school, right? Kind of a different complex set of factors that go behind the thing that might be reduced to the fact, how that actually kind of doesn't actually always sync up quite so easily with these disciplining structures, something like the statistical chart. So what happens when Black life and these disciplinary forms confront each other, I argue, is actually kind of a rupture and a really, I think, exciting one that throws into relief kind of the limits of all of these disciplinary data formations and structures and ideas, and actually demands that we see Black life and what I describe in the book as Black living, right? So something that's always kind of developing and moving and relational, that sees those as kind of not automatically, not a smooth or easy fit, right? And then so we are forced to kind of confront and see and perceive Black living and Black life in a different way. I mean, more simply put, kind of the more simple answer is that the book really asserts that what it describes as Black living is kind of always undisciplined data, because it even as it's being named as data by these kind of normative structures, it's always kind of undermining and undercutting and pressing against and pointing out the asymmetrical relationship between Black life and Black data in these really, I think, kind of beautifully disruptive ways.
Yeah, that's so interesting, and I feel like really useful and helpful if we also take, in addition to sort of thinking about Black living, we take this to help as an inroads to understand technology and like these really traditional understandings about what technology is and how it works. So one of the premises of the book is that during this period, and this really, I think, rings true, that these technologies of the social survey and photography and film were unstable in terms of the standardization of how you're, or, you know, quote unquote, supposed to use them and how you're supposed to read them. Yeah. And that it was that sort of openness around like what the heck you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to interpret this opened up all of these opportunities for the Black intellectuals and cultural producers. And so that's what helps get at the idea that racialized data, sort of like underscored data, if the idea of data is that it's pinning people down, it's fixing them in time and space, that the idea of Black living and Black sociality, it by definition defies that because it's dynamic, it's relational, all these sorts of things. So sort of to shift us into chapter one, which is really digging into the social survey as a method in particular. I wonder if you could just really simply describe what a social survey is during this period and its affordances.
So the social survey emerged and really took flight in the US context in the 1880s, and it was the direct predecessor of the social survey that emerged and took off in a British context by folks like Charles Booth. And in the US context, it was a mode of first-person investigation done either by an individual or a team that relied upon total immersion into the community, right? So it threw away the idea of kind of a detached observer who might gather information that or assemble information that other people had already gathered, right? So it's not like looking at the census data and then creating a report based on that. It's all about you are with the body of people or the community or the social phenomenon that you're trying to study. And you are interviewing people on a daily basis. Sometimes they lasted for a month. Sometimes the duration was a year to get information about the social life, right? So the social survey, the idea of the social really functioned twofold there. On the one hand, it was trying to measure and register what social life was like in this community. So say the Lower East Side, New York immigrant community, right? But on the other hand, it was kind of a social, the methodology was social insofar as you would knock door to door with something that they called a schedule, which was a list of questions, and you would fill it out. How many people live in this house? What do you do for a living? What do you do for fun? Questions like that. How many kids do you have? Where do they go to school? And really trying to get a full portrait of how people lived, right? And so one of the ethoses that was behind this was proximity, right? You had to kind of be up close, not just kind of really staring up close, but kind of living alongside. So it has all kinds of limits that now in our 21st century moment, we can understand quite clearly. Like, this really extended the reach of social control and like made it super, super up close, right? Like kind of there was no escaping a disciplinary gaze or disciplinary arm. These were largely, for the most part, white women who were doing these kinds of social surveys and social surveying, or they were the bodies on the ground, right? And so there's also a very familiar kind of dynamic of like white liberal reformers, female reformers going in and trying to fix the social, trying to reform it into their vision of what the social should be, right? What was proper and what was right. And at the very same time, it was a really exciting method, practice, and form, right, in this time period. And in this chapter, I really think about it as a method and a form, right? So after they did all of these surveys, they would bundle them together and publish them in bound books. And this was the social survey. And so in the US, the Pittsburgh survey was kind of the canonical one. It was 6 volumes. It took years of studying, and they were really trying to get at kind of the social fabric of Pittsburgh and its working class. But what was really exciting about it was, on the one hand, that I could give all this new information that hadn't been, you couldn't just see or perceive or get at through kind of dry statistical assemblage of using census data to make sense of what was going on. But it also was much like the moment in which it was produced. It was kind of this like blurry, vague, fuzzy form that was allowed people to be both the social surveyors, I should say, to be both kind of like close and distant from their subject, right? Especially when they started writing about it. There was a way in which in its narrativization of the social, right, it would allow, because the way that when they were assembled, there would be kind of narrative text and prose and then charts, right? So there was kind of a way to explain what you were seeing. And so the narrativization of the social allowed for kind of more affordances for the social surveyors and writers to account for what they were seeing. And so it became really, really popular amongst Black intellectuals, the most famous probably being W.E.B. Du Bois, who really was like, okay, if I'm here with the people, I can see things that we might not be able to see otherwise, right? I'm kind of both insider and outsider. And then I can compile an entire document that shows kind of the social rhythms, that shows kind of the historical backbeat to why things are the way they are. So it's kind of fanning out the social life of facts, as it were, which is what the social survey in theory could do. Or what I think the way that I talk about it in the book is that there was this kind of like aspiration, an aspirational sense that was underpinning or animating the social survey. Ultimately, it could never do what everybody wanted it to do. But at this moment, there was so much energy around it as a new mode of collection, a new method, and kind of also a new form.
Yeah, amazing. So your thoughts there on this as the social survey as both a method and a form is really fascinating, I think really important for historians of science and also STS scholars, because your description of it as blurry and thinking about the narrativization that it allows, it just helped me start to get a touch of traction with the concept of aesthetics, which I will say that I'm not so strong on from my own field. Also just to register for listeners that in the book, both what you write explicitly and then in your own method of following different sort of communities and actors really resonates with Sadia Hartman's work. That you can see sort of the care that you're taking there in the spirit of her work. And so picking up though on this thread of Du Bois and thinking about how Hartman uses Du Bois in her own work and how you're actually using Du Bois here, I want to hand the floor over to Beatrice.
Yes, you choose the work of Du Bois as a starting point to bringing in other cultural producers throughout the book. Yeah. What led you to such an approach and what influence did Du Bois' work have on your writing, thinking, and view of the world?
Thank you. I'm a proud student of Sadia Hartman, so I feel like the mark of her is all over this book. I feel like I wasn't so much led to Du Bois as like I couldn't escape him when I was working in this time period. So in the beginning, I was like, there's no way I'm going to write about Du Bois. This is a rabbit hole that I do not want to go down. There's too much writing. There's the archive is too big. Everybody writes about him. I can't wrestle with this figure and what he means for so many fields, right? And so many scholars. And at the very same time, he was everywhere I looked and in places that I didn't even expect to find him. So I was like, if I'm going to be talking about this time period, forget about talking about social science and data and surveys. Even before I kind of knew that those would be my landing pads, I was like, I have to deal with Du Bois in some way, just because I think that he is a through line and an interlocutor sometimes. In positive ways, some people were antagonistic towards him in this time period. Kind of everybody was thinking with him, and most people were. So that's the simple answer. I mean, the more complex answer is that I also saw in Du Bois, I saw Du Bois grappling with something that I was also grappling with about this time period, which is kind of how do we make sense of what was really clearly, on the one hand, so many figures, African-American figures from this time period's commitment to the idea that facts and data could be transformative. And on the other hand, their extreme kind of skepticism, if not like outward derision towards it. And these things were always kind of existing at the same time. I saw it in Kelly Miller, I saw it in Du Bois, I saw it in folks like Zora Neale Hurston, who I talk about in chapter 3. And so Du Bois was somebody who I would argue never quite reconciled this tension between the transformative value of data and facts and their extreme violence and their limits. And so for me, it felt really useful to kind of have him as a through line in the book to draw out kind of the way that the stakes of this question shifted according to the time period in which he was writing. So what Du Bois might say about it in 1896 when he was working with the social survey was much different than what he might say about it in 1911 versus 1928 or something like that. So kind of he became a way for me to highlight or amplify that kind of the thread that links together this 1898-1930 period is perhaps ambivalent, right? It's an open question that never gets resolved. And he's also somebody who saw aesthetics as a category is not the right word, aesthetics as the site, I'm gonna be vague here, that might actually resolve or not, if not resolve, offer some potential resolution. I think he never was quite resolved with it, to the tension between data and data's promises and its violence, or its affordances and its limits. So I opened the book by talking about Quest of the Silver Fleece, which is, for all intents and purposes, a novel and aesthetic, a work of aesthetic expression, right? That it's fiction, it's a novel, it's experimental. But it's also a text that he said himself, you know, it's more of an economic study than a novel. And it came at this moment where he's really trying to figure out how to kind of write data and aesthetics alongside each other. I mean, it's something he never gave up on. And so aesthetic production really became a useful site, whether it be kind of performance or the novel or a short story. It became a really productive site for me to look at as a location where the tension between, or the interplay between data and Black life gets staged. And so I don't have a really in-depth definition of aesthetics. I'm not like a Kantian or anything like that, but the really useful way that I started thinking about it in this book, because I would also get the question, like, what's the aesthetics here? How are you understanding it? And what does it have to do with data? And for me, aesthetics, much like data is a value system that determines what and who matters, right? So it really is ordering the sensible, right? Ordering the sensible in the visual and the legible world in terms of what matters and what doesn't. And that's exactly what data purports to do too, right? Organize the sensible world into the sensible and the non-sensible and everything that's in between. So to think about data as a site of aesthetic expression for me is to kind of think about that value system. And then conversely, to read these aesthetic productions as productions that are also generating data or kind of data's expressive forms.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's really great. Because one of the things that's so, I feel like, important about the book is showing the relationship between work that, at least in 21st century academic disciplines, is typically categorized as social science, and work that is cultural production or literary production. And through Du Bois, but many others, I mean, you use him as basically a touchstone to lead you to other people and actors, that that it's this interplay of things that retroactively are coded as falling into one of these two categories, in which they were both making truth claims.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. Yeah. And everything was so messy. Like, there was no clear line, and everything was like kind of a desperation was underpinning this moment. Like, we have to solve the problem of free Black life. So, like, I feel like it was like throwing spaghetti against the wall and seeing what sticks, like really trying anything to make sense of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things you're showing also is that there's not necessarily homogeneity around the idea of a survey.
Yeah.
As a method and a form at this time. And so on the issue of surveys and its varieties, I want to hand over to Ling Yi.
I think, although you already mentioned some of something about this social survey, but I really want to know more about, like, how, what is the stake of the Du Bois work if we compare with some earlier Europeans that statisticians, for example, like John Snow and Florence Nightingale, who were both using graphical method to present their statistics. And mm-hmm. I just want to know more about this part, because I saw this like similarities yeah. between their presentations.
Yeah, so I think that's it's really useful to think about him, and thank you for that. Think about Du Bois as somebody who wasn't just kind of emerging out of thin air in his use of statistics and diagrammatics and data visualization, that there is this long and deep history, right? Depending on what geographical location we're orienting ourselves in, that can stretch back to like antiquity, right? Of people using kind of forms or expressions of data visualization, right? So he didn't just kind of come out of thin air and innovate this. He was an innovator, but I think that there is a way that we tend to not, you know, kind of think of the rigor with which he was working and in his own deep training and all these methods. With all that to say, I think for what we see Du Bois kind of innovating in something like the Philadelphia Negro, which was all just black and white, right? They had the map in the middle and it was all black and white graphs. And Alexander Wahalia talks about this quite beautifully. But what he was insisting upon in the graphics themselves, right, was kind of the historical understanding of present conditions, right? And that in and of itself, to think of a historical life of facts and data, was something that I don't think had been at the heart of, or at least a preoccupation of some of these other folks who were using statistical graphic representations and things like that. And so and again, this is, you know, part of Alexander Wahalia's claim that I'm parroting back, is that the stakes of this in 1896 would have been quite high when people weren't kind of thinking about structural racism at all. That was not a term. So everything was just kind of, this is the biological fact of Blackness, instead of thinking about the conditions that produce what people understood as pathology or degeneracy, right? This didn't have to be this way. We have to historicize it. And we also have to insist upon a deep historical life of the conditions of Blacks living in the US. It didn't just come in 1865, right? So he really traces back well into, you know, deep in it before the 19th century to think about kind of this longer history of a Black social present. And I think that was radical in 1896.
Yeah, this is so helpful. Even though there's been so much work on Du Bois for really like thickening ways of thinking about the survey in all these other directions. Beyond that. So to shift to the next technology then, in the robust chapter two, section two, you're looking at this new unstable technology of the photograph moving mm-hmm. after the social survey. Mm-hmm. And in this chapter, you're specifically looking at anti-lynching photography. So there's a lot of work on lynching photography in terms of memorabilia, documentation, and these kinds of things. And you're pulling out the anti-lynching genre and practices through photography. And the chapter focuses on the Baker family. And this was a family that was lynched. And there's many forms of evidence, photographs, court documents, literary accounts. And conventionally, this kind of evidence reinforces the aim of technology, like the aim of the Holocaust and concentration camps for many scholars, which is to murder. Mm-hmm. And the photographic technology was sort of in one direction, it was really prized for being able to document this fact of lynching, because the photograph was prized for its ability to fix things down and pin things down and hold them still. But the Baker family completely defied photography, even as they were being photographed, because they survived the lynching. And the photographs, what they end up doing is not, you know, fixing the murdered Black body, but instead they end up producing evidence of survival that the Baker family members, the women and children, survived. It's not, they didn't escape, they didn't avoid altogether. They actually endured this technology of murder and lived beyond it and showed the political possibility of freedom and safety, something other than death. And you coined this phrase that I really love because it's so, I find it so evocative because it has two, you give it two meanings, and you can also, you show us how to recognize it in the photographic evidence. And you show a series of family photographs taken of the Baker family after the lynching. And they are in what we could just imagine as a sort of a conventional of the time setup for a family photograph. And you use the term looking out to describe what is happening by the sort of the matron of the family in this photograph. And she has a very intense and focused expression on her face, and you say that you use the term looking out to understand what the photograph was doing, the photograph technology generally was doing, because it's a position from which to look out into the future and at future individuals, but also the phrase look out as a warning, as in, you know, there's danger. You really need to look out.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if you could just sort of work through your interpretive strategy with the Baker photograph, because it's such a persuasive insight that you have, but how you go about building this argument with the photographs.
Yeah. Thank you. I worked on with this archive for a really long time, trying to figure out how to kind of tell this story of a family, six of whom survived the lynching and two who did not. And this kind of really unwieldy archive that emerged around them and through them in a lot of ways. And a large part of that, as you noted, was photographic. So I found at least, I think, 8 or 9 cabinet cards. And so like, I think there were 3x5 and some 8.5x11 photographs of the family. And as you say, I was really struck by the eldest daughter, Rosa, and her kind of, she was the only one who seemed to register any changing emotion in the photograph. So in all of the images, the family really seems to just be kind of still, they look like 9 takes, right? Very subtly changing. Like if it was the equivalent of like the live button on your camera that we have now, like it would have been really, Rosa would have been the only one who was moving. Everybody else would have been the same. But it's this really subtle kind of shift in what I initially read as like laughter. It's kind of a sly smile. Maybe I describe it as a smirk. But somehow, you know, a different kind of presence in the photographer's studio. And these were like a Victorian photography studio. So even when you were describing it and you were like photographs of lynching survivors, and I'm like, I had to be reminded that it looks like a regular in air quotes family photograph in a Victorian photography studio. You wouldn't register these as victims of lynching at first, which I think is kind of part of their power, or part of the rhetorical work that they're doing. Okay, so how did I get to thinking about this idea of looking out? One of the things that the photographs seem to demand, and it was the first part of this really capacious archive that I encountered, was it necessitated a critical framework and a visual analytic that allowed one to see lynching as something that one lives with, that one that doesn't always end life, and that one lives through, and to see lynching as kind of a durational temporal, quote unquote, event. And I don't even like to use the word event, because normally when lynching is described as an event, it's an event with a beginning and the end is always death. And this kind of complies with the way that scholars have long thought of lynching as is moving according to kind of a theatrical event, right? That has a start time and an end time. But I was like, how do I make sense of this family who survived a lynching and yet is in being captured by this photographic technology that's supposed to arrest and control, but the very condition of survivalhood is kind of a temporal position, and that defies these terms of capture. So there was, again, this kind of asymmetry between the real subjective reality of this family who survived a lynching, kind of like what it means ontologically to survive something, and then lynching photography, which seemed to just kind of have an entirely different temporality and object and goal in mind. And so looking out for me, kind of on the most basic level, describes what Rosa Baker is doing in the photograph. She's looking out rather than kind of meeting the gaze of where we would assume the photographer is based on where all her other family's gaze is going. She seems to be looking in a different direction. So either beyond to the right of the camera, to the left of the camera, above the camera, but certainly not training her eyes or her gaze in the same place as the rest of her family. So she seems to be looking in a different direction. So that's just kind of what is happening kind of technically or materially in the photograph. But the other thing that looking out seemed to be able to do was name this kind of different temporality of lynching, which I was trying to get at, which is always about kind of the ongoingness of this kind of racial violence, right? That it doesn't just coalesce in the crime of lynching, that it actually kind of, it can't be measured by this single event, right? People live with it in all kinds of ways. It moves through the body, either as kind of fear or longing or loss or different feelings of vulnerability, especially for those who, like the Bakers, survived. So looking out is kind of an anticipatory perspective, right? It's to always be kind of living on what Ariella Azoulay would describe as the threshold of catastrophe, right? Kind of this position, names this position of precarity that certainly continues to define Black life, particularly in this 1899 moment when the Baker photograph was taken. So it's about kind of anticipating, it's about naming what it means to live in a sense of space of precarity and threshold catastrophe. For me, it was a way of kind of complicating this paradigm of oppositional looking that seemed to really overdetermine readings of either Black portraiture or lynching photography, that the goal there was to kind of reverse the gaze and take some power back. This seemed to be doing something much different. So for me, it's also an ethical way of looking at these photographs for us in our current moment, to not immediately relegate them to the past, but to think about kind of the openness, the ongoingness of the photographic meaning and message. So that's a long answer, but the looking out was like oddly kind of the first part of the puzzle for me. And then I was like, okay, like how do I piece together? There were performances, there were films, there were posters, there was a court case. Like how does this all kind of comport, and how do we make sense of the fact that people took, you know, photographs were commissioned. This wasn't the family's choice, I don't think.
Hmm. No, I love that. This is my favorite kind of scholarly conversation, because you both what sort of instructed us on how to go about reading something like these sets of photographs, and in talking about specifically how you can see comparatively, there's some people who are looking at the photographer, so they have that endpoint gaze, and how Rosa is looking beyond, and that you can actually see that in the seriality of the photograph, so you can see the shifts also.
It's almost like a flip book. And it's, I mean, for me, the other thing was that, like, you know, I think to try to make photographs, lynching photographs, even if it's a photograph of an image of a violated Black body, or family photographs like this, which I also think of in the book, I classify them as lynching photographs. I think part of the challenge for Black cultural producers and intellectuals at this time period was precisely, how do we use these photographs in a way that is not going to reinscribe kind of the abjectness, the disposability, kind of the captive capturedness of Black life? And so how do you kind of use a photograph to, I think I describe it in the book as kind of sound an alarm, right? To do something and not just for a moment, but kind of an ongoing kind of political action. And so looking out is also kind of sounding a kind of a visual praxis that will sound an alarm that doesn't allow the images just to be relegated to the past too quickly or dismissed as mere evidence.
Yeah, I love being able to think about the ethics of the work itself and the ethics of the evidence. And I do also want to flag for listeners that in this chapter in particular, but also other chapters as well, there's a lot of insight about gender as well in the place of these technologies. But what I want to touch in on is this issue of temporality through the technology of photography and the impossibility of having a boundedness, sort of creating an event with a start and a finish and a particular teleology in there.
Yeah.
So for here, I'd love to have Ashley pick it up.
Yeah, so in class, we discussed themes of white supremacy and deviance in comparison to normative behavior and how labeling individuals as deviant filters out anyone who doesn't fit or match with the norm as defined by power holders. Mm-hmm. So in chapter two, the Baker family were seemingly very strategic in their method of leaving out visual context, thus preventing the storybook explanation and ending that the individuals in the courtroom had kind of gathered around to hear. And what do you think the impact of their non-normative testification was, and how does that impact the topic of deviance?
Yeah, oh, that's such a good question. Thank you. So the moment that Ashley's talking about is in chapter two, I kind of traced the Baker family from the moment where they were lynched and the family survived to their emergence as really stars and icons, although albeit briefly on the anti-lynching activist performance stage where they kind of enacted or reenacted their status as survivors by showing their wounds and being part of this larger performance repertoire. And so in between that, there was a trial of the 11 men who were accused of lynching the patriarch of the family, Fraser Baker, the youngest daughter, and they were charged with endangerment and also, I mean, this is the important part, destruction of government property, because Fraser Baker was a postmaster, which means he, you know, ran the postal operations. And when they lynched him and attempted to lynch the rest of the family, they set fire to the house, which was the post office, and burned mail. So it was considered a federal crime. So this is like probably the only reason why it went to trial, because people just weren't tried in federal trial for lynching at this time period. And so the Bakers were called to testify on the stand. And I read the testimony of Lavinia Baker, who is the mother, and Rosa and Cora, who are the two oldest daughters. And one of the things that's, you know, quite striking is that they really render the scene in what I describe as anti-photographic terms. So there's this expectation of what's going to happen when one bears witness to a crime in general. When one's on the witness stand, you're supposed to divulge everything, right? Utter transparency, kind of recreate the scene of the crime, and in this case, perform your role within the lynching or would-be lynching drama. In this case, for Lavinia Baker, it would have been mourning mother and wife, and almost victim, or she was a victim in so many ways in her own right. But they really refused to comply with this formula. They kind of evade the important details, most namely, like, did you see the attackers? And they say, no, I didn't see them. I couldn't see them. And as they keep kind of denying that they saw, you know, who attacked them, which was probably the truth, or maybe it was a survival strategy, they kind of keep saying, I couldn't see it. There were too many guns and the flash blinded me, and the bullets were the flash. And they kind of render the crime scene as a photographic encounter that ultimately doesn't reveal anything. It doesn't give us what we want, which is the identities of the victims or the identity of the family as kind of these passive mourners. Instead, they're either totally opaque in their descriptions, or they kind of emerge as theorists of photography, I argue. So they're not kind of doing what they're supposed to do. And so to finally answer your question, Ashley, I mean, what happens then is that it's total crisis. It's like a conceptual and categorical crisis. Like, they don't know if these people are victims or survivors or like evidence or or not. And it's a mistrial, which isn't entirely surprising, right? But when you read the transcripts, you can see the defense attorneys just kind of like getting frustrated when they're going through the questioning and keep trying to get them to answer the questions and to comply with their roles and what I describe as kind of this theater of the courtroom. And so on the one hand, it's this categorical crisis that ends in a mistrial. On the other hand, this crisis or this instability, I don't even know if I say this in the book, but I'm just thinking it now, really provides the conditions of possibility for this white woman reformer to come in, as she does shortly thereafter, and try to like repurpose the Baker family to matter in a different way. So kind of the instability or the interpretive messiness of this family's courtroom testimony, I think was like, okay, there's something here in this family. Maybe I can make them mean something different. So I think that's kind of, I think what the stakes of that are. And I mean, most obviously, or maybe not obviously, but I think most seemingly simple answer to that also is that it just again underlines one of the points of the book, which is that there's just not the easy compatibility between Black people and evidence, right? Like they can't serve as evidence in this way on the court stand like they're supposed to. Like they've totally failed in the eyes of the law in that role. They are evidencing something else, I argue, which is kind of the incompatibility of photography and racial violence, or photography's inability to ever capture racial violence in its complexity.
Yeah, this is so so great. And I feel like the stakes are also for sort of in the vein of history of science and science and technology studies is around understandings of witnessing and the courtroom as a site of witnessing, because sort of the conventional line in history of science and STS is that what it means to experiment is to have a public witnessing among more than one person of something so that you can like intersubjectively establish it as true. And so the idea that they are court witnesses and they are providing evidence, but it's just they're not doing it in a way that fits with the standardized way that's supposed to make sense of photography and all of these other things. It's just so evocative, I feel like, for these so many fields.
So interesting.
And so finally, you've been so generous with your time, so I want to signal that the third chapter is about the third technology that the book is exploring in terms of the experimental possibilities during this time period, and that's film. And here the launching point, the touchstone, is Zora Neale Hurston, and your concept that's really important for this chapter in particular is overexposure and the idea of overexposure. And to open out this conversation around film, I'd love to have Alicia take it over.
Yeah, so over the last century and even the past few decades, there have been vast improvements in the technology and accessibility of film. And it's no longer limited by the burden of a traditional camera, actual rolls of film available, and physically having to like cut and splice it all together. So how do you think this accessibility of film impacts the value and meaning of the data being produced within a racialized modernity?
And that racialized modernity is like our right now, our 2022. It's such a good question. I mean, on the one hand, I think like what if people in the 19th century thought that it was like the democratizing of photography, like they had no idea what they were in for with the 21st century. So on the one hand, I think that like, I think we've seen in really clear ways what the ease with which people can record and film things has had really tangible political and social implications. And I think we can even think of something like, we can obviously think of the ways in which kind of people when they are pulled over by police, right, or by agents of the state, like kind of their first impulse now is to record. So it becomes like an agent of safety or protection, right? It becomes, you know, a witness that we wouldn't have otherwise. So I think in that way, it's there's really clear consequences. I think at the very same time, or I should say, I think part of the challenge is that it also means that not that there should ever be a control of who or what should be producing media, but I think that there is. So I think also like the ease with which videos can be taken and then circulated. So that's also part of a different kind of technological infrastructure where it's not just about taking, but it's that, you know, the grid can hold the transmission really quickly. Like I remember when you used to have to like upload a video and then I would send it and receive it and download it, but kind of the speed with which things are transmitted and we receive them, I think also kind of in one way can compress what I might argue is kind of the especially when it comes to images of violence, kind of it can compress the event into a temporality that for me doesn't feel quite so easy. I don't feel at ease with. And I think it can also kind of, the volume can kind of runs the risk of overwhelming us in to the extent of inaction. This might be an inadequate answer to your question, but I think it's shifting so quickly too. Like even the examples that I used to think about were, I think are outdated now. So I'm not sure.
I think this is really I feel like it really opens up a lot about things you're talking about in terms of aesthetics. So the idea of being overwhelmed simply in terms of volume,
yeah,
as opposed to overwhelmed in an aesthetic sense in which something that's happening in this alleged form of evidence is just exceeding how I'm supposed to be understanding the event itself. So yeah, it's this aesthetic situation and how it might be easy to confuse that with just mere volume of information.
That's right. I mean, I was the example that comes to mind for me is, and it might seem obvious, but is the video of the George Floyd murder, which was really protracted in length, and also for all kinds of reasons was circulating like really rapidly and kind of a lot, right? So you couldn't even open a social media spread or any tab on your computer would show over and over and over again different people's encounters with it, reactions to it, snippets of it. And I heard from so many people, like, I just had to stop looking, or I got overwhelmed, or like, and so I think that kind of paralysis, right, which is also certainly part of kind of the aesthetic work of the emotional or affective work of aesthetics, right? It kind of overwhelms, often to the point of paralysis. But when that paralysis, then I worry that paralysis actually doesn't have the opportunity to translate into political action. And so I think that's the risk that I worry about. Some people were like, I didn't watch the video. I'm like, I don't need to see 8 minutes of this. And I certainly don't need to see 8 minutes of it for 3 hours straight on my news feed. And so I think that for me really crystallized some problems. But on the other hand, I think there's all these opportunities for like amazing kind of filmic work that's happening now independently. I think that it's allowing folks to kind of make really astute, smart films and arguments and kind of pressing against the limits and the boundaries of what even counts as film and recording in ways that are, I think, super exciting. So I think that, you know, the way that I think about it is usually in terms of kind of like documentary, but I think when it comes to other kinds of filmmaking, there's really exciting work.
Yeah, there's so much in contemporary art right now,
yeah,
that is, yeah, you can't even say it's one part documentary and one part sort of expressive work. It's just like, it's all together. And I feel like this piece of the conversation also gets at the ethics of, as you're pointing out, the circulation of materials as well, because we were really interested in moved by your decisions to reproduce images in the book itself, while also being really careful about thinking around what it means to reproduce images and to recirculate images. So to use sort of the transformative reproductions of these technological fruits and possibilities.
Yeah.
So many different directions we could go in. I'm gonna hand it over to Halcyon to sort of wrap us up here.
Hi, so in chapter 3, you discussed the metaphor of the spyglass, mm-hmm. which is being part of a community and also studying that community. Mm-hmm. I find it similar to Du Bois's idea of double consciousness. Mm. Did you feel as though this metaphor of the spyglass applied to you while writing this book, since it is about Black scholars and scientists who saw new technologies for creating data?
Well, that's such an interesting question. I hadn't thought about it as applying to me in the writing process, but I also think that I've only recently begun to really think about, kind of take a step back and think about the writing process a little bit more complexly. I think I was so close to it for so long. And then when the book first came out, I was like, I don't want to look at this book again. But I've been thinking more about kind of my own writerly practice and my own positionality and kind of how I related to the material in the book as I wrote. I think that interestingly, if I was to kind of thinking on the fly, I think that I would reject the metaphor of the spyglass as a metaphor that describes what I was trying to do in the book. Because I think one of the things that's tricky for me about the spyglass, even when Sarah Neale Hurston is using it to describe kind of what she was tasked with doing in the introduction to Mules and Men, I had the spyglass of anthropology, but then she says it was too tight. It was fitting me like a tight chemise, right? I could see the community, but there was something about kind of the mediating technology or for her anthropology, or like the mediating methodology that wasn't actually giving her the intimacy and proximity that she knew she was in this Black community, right? So the spyglass to her was a little clunky, even though it was illuminating. And so I think maybe I would have like an augmented spyglass, one that was like maybe approaching or approximating approaching, I guess would be the right word, the figures that I'm writing about, but while refusing to ever kind of pin them down. So like in the book, I really tried to let the characters move. And I say characters, but most of them are real, except the people, the figures in the novels that I write about, like let them roam, let them move, like let them come out of focus, let them come back into the frame. Like I really tried to follow the routes that they were taking me. And I think there's something about the spyglass as an anthropological tool that is actually about affixing. And I think that's why it felt a little bit clunky for Zora Neale Hurston. And that's why, in chapter 3, I'm like, the spyglass is a really useful metaphor for thinking about anthropology. But I also think kind of the camera for her was another technology that maybe in its nimbleness or presumed nimbleness could allow the Black life to kind of come in and come out of the frame. So maybe it would be something closer to like the 16 millimeter handheld camera. And I think I got that Hurston quote a little bit wrong when I was trying to run it back. But there's something about kind of the blurriness, the movement that I was trying to convey in the text.
Thank you so much for that. In thinking about your own writing practices and sort of the ethics of writing, I also want to flag for listeners that you also do a lot of work on the circulation of texts, of literary texts, and this effort again of technologies of pinning things down. But when thinking about Black literary production in your current project, thinking about the 1960s, how that opens up all kinds of experimental possibilities that head in all kinds of different directions. And I also want to flag for listeners something I also am really excited about, which is your project with the Toni Morrison Archives at Princeton, your home institution.
Yes.
And to note sort of this intertextuality that in the book that we are talking about today, The Matter of Black Living, that you begin that with a quotation from Morrison as well on data.
I know
the data geeks out there. Definitely read this book and everybody. Autumn Womack, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
This was such a treat. I really appreciate the careful and close reading. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Great, Autumn. Your generosity is incredible. Thanks so much.
I talk. And-